Hello, and welcome to Canine Bingequake, the podcast where we discuss in depth the mostly unloved and unwatched Australian canine spin-off, one of the most niche corners of the Doctor Who universe. I'm Tom, this is my co-host Kevin.
Hello.
And with us today to discuss episode 7, we have Tharys.
Tharys,
the famous YouTuber.
Oh, stop it, you're too kind.
So someone who not only has opinions about Doctor Who, but dares to show their face while saying them.
That wasn't always the case. I had some hesitancy to do that in the beginning. it's good. It's good fun.
So in all your coverage of Doctor Who on your channel, have you ever had even a moment of kind of thinking about or discussing the canine spin-off, or has it literally never crossed your mind before?
I can't say I've done it on the channel in specific. However, I can say I remember, because I knew vaguely what the show was when you reached out, because I remember seeing the pilot on YouTube some years back. So I vaguely know the premise. So when I watched House of Griffin for this recording, I was like, okay, I vaguely understand what's sort of going on in a way. There were also some questions I had, which I think you probably expected me to. But I had some knowledge of it before coming into it.
That's good. So you had a bit of a cheat sheet, yeah. Yeah, I'd imagine episode one, I mean, you know, just common sense, isn't it, is the one most people, if they have seen any, have seen that one.
Yeah.
What did you make of it?
I can't remember. It was a couple of years ago now. I remember just thinking, that was interesting. And then I never really thought about it beyond that. It was one of those things that you just thought, oh, it's a weird Australian canine spin-off thing.
So did your opinion of this one differ much from that? I mean, is this just, oh, that was interesting, and then you're going to move on with your life?
Pretty much. I mean, it was difficult. It was like, I didn't think it was, like, obviously, you know, it's difficult with, like, when you're coming into a series with, you know, relatively limited knowledge on, like, a random episode to kind of fully gauge a vibe for the show. Like, I didn't hate it. I didn't, like, love it. I was like, that sure was a functional 20 minutes of television that I watched, you know, in its way.
So you kind of got either lucky or unlucky, because basically so far this show has ranged between functional episodes, which are sort of like, that was fine, and then you forget about it in 5 minutes, and really spectacularly production train wreck ones where we spend the entire episode laughing going, what the hell just happened? And you came on in probably the most functional episode of the show so far.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense, because I didn't really see anything, like, I mean, obviously there was a couple of weird things I picked up on, like, okay, so I have a question. Is everyone meant to be from London? Because I couldn't tell, because sometimes it sort of sounded like Dick Van Dyke's Mary Poppins British accent. It's like, that was the vibe it, you know, it gave me, like, the, oh, look, yeah, you're protecting us in London from all the aliens. It's like, what's going on?
Yeah, these are all Australians pretending to be Londoners. Yes.
Yeah, I figured.
So they struggle with the accents, yeah.
Yeah, I did notice. I was like, this feels wrong somehow. This feels like parallel Britain of some variety, where everyone talks like an Oliver Twist character.
Well, this is the interesting thing, is in... Yeah, it is this sort of slightly weird off-brand Britain. We've had it compared to, you know, London if you got it from Wish. But
can I shout out my favorite example of that this time?
Oh, go on.
Yeah. You guys remember that shot of Big Ben with the storm?
That was wonderful.
Oh, yeah, no, I do remember.
This kind of weird composite matte thing with, like, lightning crackling around Big Ben or whatever it was. Oh.
It's clearly supposed to be Ben, but nothing around it looked like Big Ben.
Yeah. Yeah, the geography was all off. But actually, in many ways, this is probably, I would say, I don't know if you agree, Kevin, that the episode that sort of relies on the future London 2050 setting the least. In many ways.
Oh, is that when it's meant to be set?
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly,
I kind of gathered that they had some level of future tech, because that, right. Like, like the communication, some of the devices, it kind of gave the, I guess, the impression it was meant to be futuristic-esque. Like, the organization that that girl's mum works at. You'll have to forgive me, I haven't really retained their names very well. So I might just refer to them as that girl or one of the men or the blonde one. So if I do that, I apologize. But yeah. No, that does make sense. I just, if you hadn't have told me, I probably wouldn't have given that much thought. Like, this is one of those things. It feels like a very, if I can say it, like a very sort of almost CBBC-esque premise. Like,
yeah, definitely.
In a almost Sarah Jane Adventures kind of way of like, oh, look, we've got the ghosts of this guy's family. Like, it's very kids' TV in a kind of stereotypical sense. So it's kind of, in a sense, obviously it had some elements that I was like, okay, that's weird. But then in other ways, it was like, this is kind of what I would expect from like a kid's K9 TV show made by a bunch of Australians kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a very standard haunted house episode. We've all seen these like a million times.
Yeah,
it's,
exactly.
It's not really that different to the Eternity Trap, the Sarah Jane Adventure story. Like,
in
both, you know, kind of in what it's doing, the haunted house stuff, but also even really in quality and execution, it's not that far below. You know,
actually, I think it's better than the Eternity Trap because I'd call that a low point of the Sarah Jane Adventures.
I'd have to rewatch
this
to
a high point of K9.
Yeah,
to give you my I'd have to rewatch to give you my full comparison. One thing I noticed, obviously, I'd only seen the first episode ages ago. In this one, why is K9 so like so bitchy? That was the immediate like the immediate thing I noticed was just like,
yeah,
K9's just rude for no reason. Like, there's a bit where they're investigating the pictures. Oh, that was another thing I noticed that was futuristic. They had pictures around the house that moved, like video files, I guess.
Like Harry Potter, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But they were
like everyone has in their houses now.
Yeah, yeah. They were investigating those pictures, and K9 was like, is my supercomputer just for show? Is it my supercomputer brain? And I'm just sat there like, K9, just let them investigate. You don't need to have a quippy remark every other sentence. You know,
he's so sassy now. Yeah.
Yeah.
The writing for him is quite different, isn't it?
It's very different.
From Doctor Who, yeah.
They make him speak more like a human, surprisingly. That was an interesting thing.
Down with
like
the kids.
Yeah, it was weird because obviously, my main, obviously, I know that the show, but also, obviously, Sarah Jane Adventures would have been my main exposure to K9 as a child. And in that show, his dialogue, whilst it can be a bit sarky, particularly between him and, like, Mr. Smith, I would say, generally speaking, he still speaks like a robot. Whereas this K9 seems to speak more just like a person. It was odd. I did notice that disparity. Like, a very sarcastic, you know, sort of figure. It was
a bit where he says that not enough is going on in Darius's brain as well at the start.
Yeah, it was like a bit harsh.
So let's just double back a little bit then to sort of who these characters are. You mentioned kind of not knowing all the names and so on, but don't worry too much about that. But what do you make of them as a kind of core team then, especially compared to maybe Sarah Jane Adventures?
They're fine. Like, I had very, I guess, almost like budget, like Harry Potter vibes in a way, because you've got like the one smart girl, you've got the sort of the two boy characters who were just kind of that. So one of the boys, just so I remember, one of the boys came through with K9, right? And that's what I picked up in this episode. He was like, did they come through together? Because I swear they said something along those lines. Maybe I picked that up wrong.
That would be Starkey. He is is like this hacktivist character who K9 blew his original self up to save and regenerated into this new snarky version.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. I remember seeing like the regeneration-y change thing. So yeah, there's him who came through, and then there's the blonde one, the tall blonde guy, and then there's the girl with the weirdly overprotective mum, and I don't know whether that has much bearing on the rest of the series. They're fine. I didn't,
the mom is like, she's like this political war criminal who involves aliens.
It's not very clear from this episode, because as I was saying, that this one does the least really in terms of the world building of modern, future London. But this is meant to be a fascist authoritarian dictatorship. The department.
Is it?
Yeah. You wouldn't know, really.
My mom commits hate crimes on an institutional basis. Also, she doesn't like it when I stay out late with boys. Who knows which is the bigger crime?
My assumption was like, she was like, because they talk about, like, the girl says something to the effect of, oh, you know, how can I not feel safe when my mum's fighting aliens and keeping us all safe? And it's like, oh, I'm glad you approve of my work or whatever it was. I was like, is this like BTEC unit? But no, apparently it's...
It's just evil, yeah.
Just evil, just okay. Which is...
So she works for them, and she's quite a big part of the overarching series so far. She's mm-hmm. not, I don't know if she's quite in every episode, but in maybe I think she has been, at least in most of them. And yeah, she's not in this much. She basically just rings in to check up on Georgie, that's the girl's name, on how she's doing and if she's safe, basically.
If she hasn't died.
But it did lead to one of my favourite lines, actually, which was the woman who put the mother in smother.
Yeah.
That was quite witty. Especially because even though it is basically just a funny remark, it actually is weirdly appropriate to describing the other mother in the story, who is Professor Griffin's
wife, yeah.
Who turns up. We'll talk about that in a bit, his missing family. But yeah, that was a neat little...
Are we giving this credit with parallels?
Maybe we are. Maybe we are. We've been doing it too long.
Well, yeah, you guys are 7 episodes in, so I imagine, like, obviously my perspective on it is very much someone who's just come in and gone, that was functional. Like, obviously you've seen the other 6, so it might, in context, you might look at it differently, or you might see it as better or worse than I potentially would. Because I guess I don't have, like, a frame of reference as much as you two do.
Yes, Tom and I sometimes shoot each other messages when we watch the episode to be like, oh, that was interesting or whatever. This was one of those where I shot a message over to Tom and said, I'm not used to the show being like straightforwardly good, which goes to show how low we've sunk.
Yeah, this is the high bar, really, of the show at the moment.
And even then, I kind of just felt, again, it was like, it was very, you know, it was very like average kids TV sort of. It almost had, I don't know whether either of you saw it, like CBBC, like Am I High? Vibes almost, in that way of like, oh, the kids have got all this weird technology and they've got this older bumbling guy who seems to be their like mentorish type figure, the Griffin guy.
Yeah.
I imagine is the Sarah Jane equivalent, I assume.
Yes, it's a very stock setup, isn't it? Yes, the bumbling adult. Well, I suppose Sarah Jane isn't bumbling, but yeah, there usually is one who's kind of like that. And
yeah.
So what would you make of Griffin then, the professor character?
I mean, it's difficult with this one because I imagine this isn't how he would normally act because he's having to deal with the reappearance of his family. He's about, I guess, what I would expect from one of these shows, like a sort of scientific gal. I mean, it's weird that, like, in a way it's kind of odd because he has that, like, time portal thing. And K-9 has a line about something about how each time he uses it to try and locate his family, he warps time into a very specific shape, and that's how they explain. Did you like my inflection for K-9 then? I even like did the little register. Yeah. And it's like, surely you'd think if you were warping time to that degree, you'd eventually like try and stop, but no, he just carries on. It almost feels like he's on the verge of a villain origin story. It reminded me of Kingpin and Into the Spider-Verse, when he's trying to get his family through the multiversal portal thing. Maybe that's not how it's meant to be read, but I couldn't help but draw that comparison.
What you're showing is that it's very easy to pitch a more interesting show than the one we've been watching.
I don't know to what extent he's meant to be aware that he's distorting time each time he does it. I don't know. I can't recall if that's clear or not. But yes, that's the sort of weird technobabble that they use to justify this sort of, you know, spectral phenomena of the 3 ghosts turning up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically a classic gothic ghost story. In fact, it tips its hand in a sort of gothic direction lots of times because the title is The Fall of the House of Griffin, which is obviously riffing on Edgar Allan Poe, The Fall of the House of Usher, and they read The Raven.
Is that the poem?
That was hacky. Yeah.
That was very...
We've heard that too many times.
it's very sort of, oh, we need to do some kind of establishing of atmosphere and creepy tone, so let's read a bit of a creepy poem.
Look, if The Simpsons has already sent that up, just don't do it.
Although I will say, I mean, on that note, that at least this one does have a basically consistent tone and atmosphere all the way through, doesn't it? It doesn't kind of veer wildly into...
I kind of wish it did, though, because I think that would have been more interesting in a way. Like, do you know what I mean? Because this one was so functional, I'm sort of coming away from it being like, yeah, you know, that, like, it's for what it is, it does its job, like, I just have, I guess, not little to say on it. I guess it's just my feelings aren't as strong as perhaps, you know, some of yours might have been on previous episodes that were a bit more outlandish and wacky with their tone. I do have a question, though, and it comes in the form of, there's a bit earlier on in the beginning where Griffin is talking to the mother character briefly, and the mother says, can you try and exert some parental control? Mm-hmm. And Griffin responds, like, of course. So are they meant to be related or in any way? I wasn't sure.
No.
No.
Okay. Actually, was very strange in this episode because the whole climax sort of hinged on them being like, we're basically family. And I was just watching that going, are you?
Yeah, I kind of looked at them and I was like, you just sort of look like some weird science blokes, like young interns.
Yeah, I mean, as with other episodes, the previous one had this kind of thing of, you know, face your fear and learn that your fears are just imaginary. It was trying to do a kind of, you know, well-meaning lesson for kids sort of thing. And the same one here, it was trying to do a sort of, you know, found family versus the real one. Although obviously they're not really his real family, mm-hmm. so it doesn't quite work. But they were trying to do a kind of, you know, oh, the people that he's with now and the present, that's what matters. He can't dwell on, you know, misery of the past and all this stuff. They were trying to do that, I guess. But like Kevin said, there isn't the same sense that they cohere as a team in the way that the Sarah Jane Adventures guys.
Actually, just wanted to pick up on a point you dropped there briefly. The last episode is a really good point of comparison because we got, which is unusually poor planning because this show seems to at least have a good idea of what episode should go where. Two horror-based episodes in a row. Last time we had that Fear Itself one about. So there is basically last week was about a haunted wardrobe that was bigger on the inside, but only if you were afraid of the wardrobe. Meanwhile, all of society went into riots because everyone was scared. And Kay and I went inside the wardrobe and it was really bad and really sloppily made, but also really funny as a result, whereas this is competent, makes sense, and
yeah,
there's nothing to say. I watched it last night, and I immediately woke up this morning thinking, oh god, what am I going to say? Sorry, continue.
I was going to say, another comparison I drew was the, I've only seen a couple of episodes of this, and this might be an incredibly niche reference, I'm not sure, but there was a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids TV show that ran in America. And the premise of this very much gave me the vibe of that show in that basically, because obviously they can't shrink the kids every episode, basically the dad will come up with some crazy scientific invention concept and the two kids and the, you know, the mum and the family will sort of have to deal with that week's, you know, conundrum type thing. And it kind of, again, gave me that vibe. So it was, I guess this is all to say it very much gave me like kids' TV vibes, like very much.
So wait, so the dad's kind of meddling or whatever is sort of causes the problem of the week.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Which kind of gave me similar vibes to this because obviously it's a direct result of Griffin's desire to see his family that leads to the conflict in this episode.
I think this is only the only one of which that's really been true. Although obviously it's definitely true of this one, but I think. Yeah, most of the rest of the time. So the big space-time portal thing that you've been referring to, the space-time manipulator or whatever it's called, that's kind of their version of Torchwood's Rift or, you know...
I see, that makes whatever. Sense.
And so stuff just comes out, you know, monsters come out of that every week and so on. And most of the time,
I gotta say, that supports your read of him as the villain theories.
Exactly, you know, like, why can't you just turn it off? If you're constantly getting aliens through it each week and bam, a robot dog pops out of it the first week, maybe just turn it off a bit. I'm trying to think what else I kind of thought watching it. The accents was the main thing that jumped out to me immediately, like before even any of the plot stuff. I guess, like, what's the blonde kid's story? What does he do? Because, like, he doesn't really do anything. Like, you're sort of giving me, like, Yaz in series 11.
He's basically like the houseboy for Professor Griffin.
I think there's been something about how his parents split up or something, or he was on the streets.
He's been living with Professor Griffin for a while, has been my impression, more or less. And honestly, that I felt like this episode really totally forgot about that, because the emotional climax comes across as, look, Starkey, you're basically the professor's son. Oh, hi, Darius, you're also there.
Yeah.
despite Darius knowing the professor longer and having a more established relationship.
The resolution is quite rushed and weak, isn't it? Which is a consistent issue with the show. I mean, in fairness, as we've said before in other episodes, that can be quite an issue with Doctor Who itself. And obviously that Doctor Who has, you know, 45 minutes to tell a story and set things up, and this only has 22 or 23 or whatever it is.
I think a fundamental problem with stories like this in terms of that emotional climax is a sort of main character syndrome, where Starkey is nominally the main character in the show, so every character relationship and piece of drama has to be filtered through that lens, even when it doesn't actually make emotional sense for the world they've built, which, you know, happens in a lot of things, but it's especially a problem in, you know, low budget, slightly crap series where it's just sort of working off its premises and not really thinking about the implications, and it doesn't work.
Speaking of low budget, I just want to say the end climax scene where I guess bodies are being harvested by the ghost so they can use them to regain consciousness. When they say something to the effect of, oh, they've used their ghostly powers to pin us to these boards, like, there's nothing stopping you getting up and walking off that board. Yeah. There's nothing there.
They just wobble around on these, like, trolleys really undramatically, don't they?
And it's like, I'm just not convinced you're in that much peril, to be honest. I just, you know, it was, yeah. Also, that actually, that's something I want to say. Since when can canine fly?
Ah, well, since he regenerated.
Right. I don't know why they decided to do that, because it doesn't look very good. There's a bit where, obviously, they see him, they see the ghost at the first bit, and he scans them. Obviously, he can't scan them fully because they're not fully alive, which makes sense. But then there's a bit where he's like, there's nothing there, Starkey, or whoever he says it to. And it's like, but you know there is, though. Obviously, they're not physical entities, but they do exist, canine. You know,
yeah, I think the logic sort of wobbled a bit there. Yeah,
they're trying to do like some sort of science versus magic, skepticism versus believing thing, and it's just like they have not thought through any of the premises. So canine looks like an idiot for being scientific, and it's just like, why do that?
In terms of vibes, I think the makeup on the kids and the wife was quite good.
Yeah,
the kind of these sort
of creepy as hell. Yeah, they did a good job.
Blue veins kind of sticking out through their sort of pale skin. I mean, you know, that's quite, you know, that's fairly basic to do, but that's probably why it worked quite well. It wasn't a sort of monster that was beyond the achievement or budget of the show. It was just three people looking slightly creepy, and that worked quite well. And
although I will say, I'm a scaredy cat who gets jumped by everything. I don't think there was a single point where I got jumped in this, which maybe I'm not saying.
Oh, you just reminded me of one of my favorite moments, though. The moment where they see the scary kids pop up looking like they're out of The Shining and ask, where are your parents? That's the normal reaction.
Where are your parents?
I thought that as soon as I saw that, I was like, wow, someone's watched The Shining recently. I noticed that. It was very codified in like the horror tropes. Yep. I suppose.
There was this weird bit where I don't quite know what Griffin was doing. Actually, this is a bit of a weakness, I think, of the episode, is that Griffin disappears from the middle of it for some reason.
Yeah, he just sort of leaves. And I'm like, oh, you were here.
He's in this other room. Well, there's a bit where he looks at a picture of the family, and fair enough, that, or video footage of the family, that makes sense. But then there's a bit where there's a harp in the corner, and he's lighting candles, and there's classical music playing, which is all very gothic vibes, tropes, lovely, you know, nice atmosphere. But why? What is he doing?
I think this is a good time for me to have a rant about one of my least favorite tropes in genre fiction.
Oh, go on.
Which is a lot of times when people want to tell a character drama story but be very lazy about it, they turn to tropes like hypnosis or that kind of thing to have the characters basically look like, or basically act out an idiot plot until the resolution where they can finally make the obvious choice that the episode is built around and get the emotional catharsis. So in this episode, Professor Griffin's entire behavior makes no goddamn sense. He's taken out of the episode to basically, for no reason, totally fall head over heels for these obviously murderous ghosts until the last minute when he finally sees sense and goes, oh yeah, no, that's actually a bad idea. Which, the basic shape of it makes sense if you're pitching a story to be like, oh, he's tempted, and then he resists the temptation. But they don't actually have a second act to that story. They just have a start and an end. And the rest of it, he's just standing to the side acting like an idiot. I hate plots like that.
And it's not really a temptation if you're hypnotized or in a trance anyway, is it? Because, you know, there is no choice.
I was going to say, I was very confused by that, because obviously the fact, it's not built up well that he's in a trance at all.
It's very wobbly logic, yeah. Something else, a production that I wanted to mention is, this is the first episode where I noticed the score, the music, being quite decent. I don't know if
you thought that,
Kevin, compared to other episodes. Or
I did. Actually, I was surprised to find I was recognizing some of the motifs at this point. Like, not like firmly, but like it would start to play and I would sort of start humming it in my head and go, oh, I've been watching this show too much.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing I was going to mention, which, Tharys, you might not have seen, is this episode was directed by Daniel Netheim, who goes on to do 4 Capaldi-era episodes. Oh. Yeah, the Zygon two-parter and then Extremis Pyramid at the End of the World. And he's done some Broadchurch and things like that. So he's had a really good career, but this is kind of earlier on. So yeah, quite random.
I don't really have much fault in the directing itself, beyond obviously, like, you know, obviously budget limitations, but I wouldn't blame that on the directing so much as just, you know, the constraints put on the show itself. I mean, I don't mind the setting itself, as in, I quite like his house, like Griffin's house.
It's a decent set, isn't it?
It's a nice enough set. Although I still stand by the idea that he just has a portal that just lets aliens through. It just doesn't seem like a worthy investment of time. But the idea of that is also quite fun. I think if they had maybe presented it more like a Rift type of thing in Torchwood, where the like first line of defense from that Rift, and like the house was built specifically around that Rift to contain it or study it or whatever, that would be a bit more believable. Although why you just put a bunch of kids there and a dog remains to be seen. And even then, before then, you know, the dog wasn't there. So it would literally just be a bunch of kids and like a scientific guy.
This gets at something that I think is a problem with, or, you know, something that has to be struggled with by all these sorts of shows, which is, in no sane world is the front line, you know, against aliens or whatever, a team of kids.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the same in, obviously that's made a deliberate point of in something like Class, where, you know, the characters kind of
I think you can buy it in Sarah Jane Adventures in so much as that Sarah doesn't really want them involved initially, so there's at least a bit of like trepidation there. And obviously as well, she tends to face smaller threats anyway, like in most, obviously, I know that you can argue that in one of the Sarah Jane Adventures episodes they try to turn out the sun, but like, which probably is, you know, quite a big deal for children to deal with. But I suppose there's an element of suspension of disbelief there, because generally speaking, you know, you never have Sarah Jane facing like Cybermen. You know, they kind of scale it back a bit. You know, it's like the Slitheen are like her big bad, and then you'll occasionally get, you know, things like the Bane and things like that, like smaller level threats. So you can kind of buy it. With this, it's like, so there's just a portal. There's like a rift in time that could bring out whatever God knows. And there's just, and I guess as well, I mean, at least to me, obviously, the Sarah Jane lot seemed better equipped, because you had Mr. Smith and K-9 and Sarah Jane, who actually seemed to know what she was doing. Whereas with this bloke, he just sort of seems, obviously I've only got this episode to base it off of, and the whole point of this is that he's not acting like himself, but I can't say I'd be particularly trusting of him if I was put in his care in this scenario, you know? Whereas with Sarah, you kind of at least get the sense of, oh, she actually knows what she's doing and is competent, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The one other thing I thought was really interesting in terms of the tropiness and predictability of the plot was, after the plot was resolved, there was a very strange little moment of the ghost mother turning to the kids and saying, I'm sorry, darlings, or whatever, we're not wanted here. And that was fascinating to me, because after an entire episode of them being just cartoonish villains, we get a moment of vulnerability where, for me at least, it was sort of making me wonder, well, maybe they could have been the real deal. And I honestly wish the episode had leaned more into that. It would have made the temptation plot stronger. It would have made it more emotionally resonant, and it would have made it more complex. It's just that little moment of seeing an episode that could have been way more interesting than the functional thing we got, that's going to live in my brain for a while.
Would be cool if a later episode is just, oh no, they were real and you just missed your chance to reunite with them. Kind of funny, but also tragic as well.
Yeah.
I had just one line that there's a very, very cringy kind of, it was almost like the sort of the hero pun moment of the episode, which is when Starkey says, you know why ghosts are such terrible liars? Because you can see right through them, which is very cringy. But I wanted to both say that it was cringy and also say I don't think it's actually worse than anything that they might have given Clyde or whatever on Sarah Jane.
I laughed.
Oh yeah, I didn't mind that too much.
Yeah.
I wasn't properly groaning at it. It was just like, yeah, it seems like a sort of joke the show would do, a show like this would do. Honestly, as I said, I think the more distracting dialogue for me was K-9's. Like, there's that bit where he's just kind of like slagging off the house, because he's, I think one of the children he's with, I can't remember, they're going down the stairs, and the kid says, oh, you know, when does anything make sense here? And K-9 makes some remark about how, like, oh, he's been asking the same question for ages. Mm. And then the kid's like, why do you stay? And it's like, because I'm needed. And I'm like, I feel like you're needed in more crucial places than some weird house in not London that has a portal in it that could probably be closed if the guy just got over the fact that his family were dead. Sorry. This doesn't really justify, you know, you.
Well, for example, he could be needed in the Sarah Jane Adventures where this show is legally keeping him out of it.
Exactly. So this exists, I assume, purely in its own continuity. I suppose.
It doesn't seem to really fit with any other Who stuff, no.
Yeah. Which I guess it can't, because they don't really have the rights to it. Although I do remember... Okay, so I might have completely fantasized this, but I seem to remember in episode one, when K-9 is found, they find, like, a case with, like, a Gallifrey insignia on it. And it plays, like, a little bit of, like, the Doctor Who theme, or as much as they're allowed to play.
Very subtly, yes. Very subtly. The first three notes of the theme or something, and it's got the Theta Sigma symbol on it or something on the case.
So how could they get away with that, but not,
I guess, because it's so tiny. No one noticed.
I see. So they just snuck it past the BBC. It's like, no, we're not talking about Doctor Who. Don't worry. It's fine. Everything's fine. We're just making our totally separate and distinct K-9 show where... Also, that's another thing. Obviously, I don't actually mind the K-9 redesign.
Yes, we haven't talked about that. Yeah.
I don't mind it that much. What I will say is, weirdly, it does look cheaper than the original prop, which is weird because, you know, the original prop dates back to the 70s. Obviously, I know that in the 2000s it probably got altered a bit, but... I don't know, because despite the fact they've tried to make it look more futuristic, the metal looks more plasticky.
Yeah, it looks more like a toy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And it kind
I do like the ears. I like that he can point in different directions with his ears. That's quite funny.
I quite like the fact that his mouth has some, like, I guess, glowy bit, kind of Cyberman-esque. Like, when he speaks, it sort of glows blue. Mm. When he speaks. Also, I did notice there was some more modulation on John Leeson's voice in general. It's very sad that I picked up on that difference, but, like, just
it's
a bit more robotic than it kind of was in the show. In the show, it's kind of just John Leeson doing the K-9 voice, whereas they put a bit more, like, of a robotic filter over the top of it in this show, which I don't really mind.
Wrapping up then, do you think you will dare to watch any more of this show? Now you've seen this one episode, you've seen the premiere, do you think you will dip your toe any further?
I mean, if this is the peak, I don't know. Like, if that's the thing. You know, if you'd have told me, oh, this is, you know, one of the mediocre episodes, and there's actually some really, really good ones, I might have gone, all right, you know, that was a decent thing, I might check it out more. But if you're saying this is, you know, it's all downhill from here, or at the very least... this is about as good as it's going to get, I might not. But yeah, I mean, it was fun anyway. I did enjoy it. I mean, the thing is, it was... I think, considering it was only like 20 minutes long, it was quite well-paced. Obviously, the ending was a bit, you know, skew-iff, but that was kind of what I was expecting. But, like, I didn't feel, you know, like I was sort of forcing my way through it, if that makes sense. It didn't feel like it was... taking ages to get to any, like, point or anything like that. You know, I didn't begrudge its existence, if you like. I was more so just like, yeah, it was fine.
That's a review they can put on the box then. Not begrudge its existence.
I did not begrudge its existence. You can feel free to make more Australian K-Line spin-offs to your heart's content. It just seems weird to try and create a spin-off franchise based on K-9 of all things. Like, it's just, K-9 was never meant to be a front to a, you know, his own show, yes. Let alone, you know, a franchise. You know, there's a reason why K-9 and Company never got continued past, I believe, its pilot episode. There's just not enough there for him to be the focal point of a show. And I know, obviously, that's where you could say, well, the human characters could kind of pick up the slack. But I guess the problem is the human characters didn't do a lot for me at all. Like, they were just generic, sort of kids show characters. You've got, as I said, the sort of bumbling adult and the sort of Hermione Granger smart type with the overprotective parent, and then the two other ones, which I don't really, you know, especially the blonde one. I have no idea what his role is. He kind of gave me Yaz vibes in series 11 of, oh, you're here, I forgot that. But yeah, there's something else I was gonna say and it's gone, but if I forget it now, it's done. But yeah, I really enjoyed talking about it, at the very least.
Thank you very much for joining us. Yes,
no,
it was good fun. I assume, you know, most people listening to this will already know where they can find you. Do you want to just briefly mention that?
Sure. So if you want to check my YouTube, that's my main thing. That's just Therry, so Therries. If you dare go on to Twitter, which, to be fair, I don't blame you if you decide not to, that's at TherriesYT, where you will see my more off-the-cuff things.
Cool. And Kevin, same as usual.
Yep. I'm still on Twitter at ScribbleScript, and I still have a Faction Paradox story that TARDIS Wiki refuses to summarize. I may have made it hard for them, but still, someone do it.
And as usual, you can follow us at K9BingeQuake or email us k9bingequake@gmail.com, and we will see you all again soon. Thanks for joining us, Darius.
Thank you. Goodbye.
You have been listening to K9 BingeQuake with your hosts, Tom Marshall, Kevin Bernard, and special guest, Therries. This episode, Putting the Mother in Smother, was recorded the 5th of February 2023 and was edited by Kevin Bernard. The music was composed by Jack Guidera. Thank you for listening, and remember, if the professor turns out to be the big villain, well, we owe Therries some goddamn cash money.